from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Years ago, about 100,000 people came to San Francisco to take part in the musical and cultural revolution known as the Summer of Love. That year brought us familiar and enduring songs like Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles' Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, but whatever happened to songs like I Was Kaiser Bill's Batman by Whistling Jack Smith, which hit the top 20 charts? We'll look back at the musical legacy of the summer of 67, including some of the then-popular tunes that have been lost to history. It's all coming up after the news.
Excuse me while I kiss the sky. Purple haze all around. Don't know if I'm coming up or down.
Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. 50 years ago was the Summer of Love. Hippies flooded into San Francisco and music was everywhere. And let's take a minute to listen to the Youngbloods from 1967.
If you hear the song I sing, you will understand. Listen. You hold the key to love and fear. All in your trembling hand. Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your command. Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now.
Well, joining me to talk about the music of the Summer of Love this hour is San Francisco-based music writer Joel Selvin. He's here with us in the studio. Welcome, Joel.
Michael, good to be here.
Glad to have you here. And, well, we're both getting corroded by age with memory and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, there are many out there who don't remember the Summer of Love, and a lot of people nostalgic about it, but a lot of people who literally have no memory about it because they weren't there then. Set the scene for us. I mean, you've written so much about it. You were so immersed of it, in it, and so much a part of it. And you've written about the darker side of it as well. So let's call this the zeitgeist. What is the zeitgeist of the Summer of Love?
You know, Michael, in San Francisco, the Summer of Love was really 1966. By 1967, the hippie thing had become a subject of mass media, mainstream news coverage, and a subject of immense controversy. In 1966, the summer before, it was a secret shared by a few thousand people living in a couple of neighborhoods.
Pure and undiluted by 67.
Yeah, it was the real deal.
It was
yeah.
All popular culture stuff. Huh?
And, in October 65, they had the first real hippie rock dance over at Longshoremen's Hall, and there were 1,000 people there. Almost everybody that was there looked around and went, wow, I didn't know there were so many of us, right? So then we flash forward to January 1967. The human being at Golden Gate Park, you know, crowd estimates are difficult, but it, undoubtedly upward on 100,000 people show up, and everybody looks around and says, I didn't know there were so many of us. So that gives
sort of
you
like
some,
the Bernie Sanders supporters in the beginning.
It's a give you an idea of how like explosive that whole was over the year of 66. I mean, it just went from a small, tiny little thing to something that everybody wanted in on.
But everybody wanted in on it because of, you know, come together and all that spirit and all that feeling of communal, whatever you want to call it, love and beads and sandals and the rest of it. I mean, it was a whole way of life, kind of out of the Bohemian period, out of the Beatnik period.
Yep.
It sort of morphed and everything. But as you've pointed out, you wrote a book about Altamont. In fact, that's your most recent book, Altamont, which we talked about here, The Rolling Stones, The Hell's Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day.
Thank you.
It was always, I mean, you know, you had Charles Manson, you had all of those kinds of things as well that somehow are become associated with what I call the zeitgeist of the 60s and the summer of love.
Yeah, well, of course, that's much later, and so many things changed.
It was nascent then, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think Manson was around San Francisco in 67.
Maybe even not Manson, but all the drugs and all of the excesses.
Yeah, by June 67, things had really moved from the flower children, and now we were seeing street people.
Well, let's hear some of the music. That's what this hour is all about. And what I want to have people hear, young people may not even know this song, but it was a classic from the so-called Summer of Love. This, give us a little preview, if you could, Joel. White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane.
Grace Slick brought this song to the Jefferson Airplane when she joined the band in October of 66. She'd been in a group with her soon-to-be ex-husband and his brother. It was called Great Society. And they played down the bill on that first hippie rock dance at Longshoreman's Hall from the Airplane.
And to this day, I cherish a memory of my interview with Grace Slick where she said to me at the end of the interview, "This was great," and hugged me and kissed me. Here's that was a big deal at the time.
No, that's good, yeah.
Let's hear.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits, and you know you're going to fall, tell them a hookah smoking caterpillar has given you the call. You call Alice when she was just small.
Well, that's White Rabbit, Jefferson Airplane. It makes me think of Paul Kantner and makes me think of special times, of course. I wasn't here yet. I didn't come until 1970, but the reality is that that song became an anthem, really.
It was all over the radio by June of 67. That was the Airplane's second album, came out in February, and White Rabbit was just an instant success, and it was the first postcard out of the San Francisco music scene, and that was widely presumed to be the tip of a massive iceberg because, of course, you know, the San Francisco bands were entirely unheard outside of San Francisco until summer 67, Monterey Pop Festival.
This is a song, though, that we associate with people like Tim Leary to this day, you know, One Pill Makes You and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, that's an LSD reference, you're right. The whole San Francisco scene was based in the use of psychedelic drugs. That's what created it. That's what these bands were about. That's what the audiences were about. That's what the Fillmore and the Avalon were. They were psychedelic speakeasies.
Well, let's hear another, I suppose, anthem from that period. And Joel's next book, by the way, is going to be on the Grateful Dead. Here's Golden Road to Unlimited Devotion, Grateful Dead. We're talking about and listening to the music of the Summer of Love, and we'd like to hear from you. What is your favorite song from the Summer of Love, or give us some of your memories? We do welcome your involvement in the program And let me tell you how you can become a part of this program. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, kqed.org, or tweeting us. We're at KQED Forum, and you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Joel Selvin with us here in studio. And let me actually talk about The Grateful Dead for just a moment with you. As I said, your next book, give me another plug here. Next book is going to be on The Grateful Dead, but post Jerry Garcia. But Jerry Garcia, in many people's minds, was The Grateful Dead.
Yeah. Yeah. I just thinking about Garcia at, in 66, 67, the Grateful Dead were one of five bands that constituted the front line of the San Francisco scene, and they hadn't really distinguished themselves in any further than as they would. But Garcia was always an
Didn't have any single hits for quite a while, in fact.
Oh, no, they were always a background band. They were just part of the scene. They were part of the community. They couldn't get arrested outside San Francisco and Manhattan for years. Yeah, Garcia, you know, he played all over the Airplane's second album guitar on two or three songs, and he was just such an obvious figure right away on the scene, of somebody who knew what was going on, who was a radiant source of energy, amazing guy. You know, the story about the first time he met Bill Graham was there was at the acid test, not the acid test, the Longshoreman Hall, 3 days, January 66, they hired, the Pranksters hired Bill Graham, this sort of square guy, to produce this controlled chaos, and the Grateful Dead were supposed to play, but somebody had stepped on Jerry's guitar and broken the neck off, and the Dead were all just loaded to the teeth on acid anyway, and so they weren't going to play. But Jerry comes over to the stage to collect his gear, and there's Bill Graham, and he's never seen this guy before, and he's crouched down on the stage with some tape trying to put this guitar back together that's never going to go back together. And Jerry said he was just filled with the sort of warm feeling for this guy doing this absolutely impossible thing. And that was the meeting of Bill Graham and Jerry Garcia.
I remember, I did a little show many, many years ago at KTIM in Marin County, kind of an alternate rock station. When I first walked in, I saw the Plasmatics, and I thought, this says volumes, you know, about what's here. And Doug Wendt used to do a Rasta show.
I
walk in one night, I could have got a contact high from the smell of marijuana, and he said to me, Mike Krasny, meet Bob Marley. That's the only thing my younger daughter, has ever impressed about in my whole broadcasting career. But, you know, the reality was that I called Bill Graham. You know, I had to do your own calls in those days, and I said, I'd like to interview you. And he's, what's in it for me? That was his response, immediate response. I said, I don't know. It's just going to be an interview. You know, have a good conversation, so forth. We're talking, by the way, about listening to the music of the Summer of Love. And again, we'd like to bring you into this. So feel free to join us with your thoughts about that period, which has now become a big part of popular culture. There is, of course, an exhibit at the D. Young Museum. We talked about it. We were trying to mainly promote the African-American exhibit of the South art, which is there simultaneously. But I don't want to give a short shrift to the Summer of Love exhibit. It's also certainly well worth seeing, as drawing in droves of people. We're talking to Joel Selvin, and I wanted to actually have us hear a song that became probably more identified than maybe any other song, other than perhaps the song we heard, White Rabbit, by the Jefferson Airplane. And Selvin hates it, but let's hear a little of it. This is Scott McKenzie. All right. Not only did you hate that song, Joel, and continue to hate it, but you felt all the hippies did back in the day.
Yeah, let's straighten this out, because I told your producer I didn't say I hated the song. I kind of have a sick affection for it. I'm especially fond of the Tanya Tucker cover version. But what I told her was the hippies hated this. This is a song by John Phillips of the Mamas and Papas.
Who I interviewed at KTIM after the song became, a few years later, of course.
Was that on the Old Liver or the New Liver?
No, that was on the Old Liver.
But it was a commercial for Monterey Pop Festival, which Phillips was the producer of. And it was written and performed and recorded in the old style of Hollywood pop rock that the San Francisco bands were just about to destroy. It's everything that the San Francisco bands were against, where they were the opposite of. It's tight, it's tuneful, it's commercial, it's all gussied up with Hollywood production effects, and it's corny as hell. The San Francisco bands were anti-show business, they were anti-cornball, they were anti-everything this song is.
Reminds me, Pete Sears is an old friend of mine.
Great guy indeed,
and when they did that big hit, he was part of Jefferson Airplane, it became Jefferson...
Starship.
When they had the huge hit, We Built This City and everything, he was almost embarrassed about it, because it was so, pop music. And they weren't embarrassed
at the time. They enjoyed very much having a hit record.
Yeah,
they
liked
that.
The checks and everything, I'm sure, but that's besides the point.
Oh, no, I remember that they took it out of the track out of the studio the night that they'd recorded it and went to some Mexican restaurant and put it on the sound system and made them play it over and over and over again at this Mexican restaurant. We're going to have a hit record.
It's also what they call PR. Talking again with Joel Selvin and Emmanuel Hapsis, who's an editor of KQED's Pop and host of KQED's Pop Cultural Podcast, which is called The Cooler, is here with us in the studio. And Emmanuel has been doing some really fine writing about the Summer of Love, which was long before you were born, right?
Yeah, I was not there. But I've done some research, and I brought some not-so-great songs, unlike the ones we just heard. These kind of fell away for whatever reason. They're more or less forgotten. And I'm interested in how history is crafted and what is left out of the picture. These songs that we're going to hear did chart and were popular at the time, but now we look back and we're like, why was that a thing?
Well, let's actually hear from, since we're talking about San Francisco songs, this is, and by the way, I have to ask you why you talked about that song by Scott McKenzie as pure bop. What is boppy about
it? I'm so glad you asked. So the kids these days, if a song is a jam or something that we love, we call it a bop, B-O-P. Sometimes it's a capital bebop or just a bop.
Yeah, but we all old-timers associate it with bebop back in the day. Yeah. Well, let's hear a song and give us a little preview of this. It's called Let's Go to San Francisco by the Flower Pot Men.
Yeah. Do you like that Mary Jane reference they just slipped in there?
Very good.
So, yeah. So the Flower Pot Men are from the UK, and they looked over at what was happening with Scott McKenzie. It was selling 7 million copies. It was an instant classic. And they're like, we need to get in on this whole let's ditch our lives and live it up in San Francisco movement. And so they're just like, well, we'll just copy what he did. And so their song is called Let's Go to San Francisco.
And let's hear.
Yeah.
And that was released only a few months after the Scott McKenzie song. What was it? It was kind of a one-hit wonder, but mainly in the UK.
Yeah, they were basically like the Milli Vanilli of their time. Is that the first time someone said Milli Vanilli on forum?
Did they also move their lips while the music played, like Milli Vanilli?
Who knows? They never had another hit after that, so we'll never know.
Emmanuel Hapsis is with us again, and we're talking about some of those hits that you didn't know were hits during this period, and some of you may not remember. And here's one that really speaks of the time. It's An Open Letter to My Teenage Son by Victor Lundberg. Let's hear from you on this, Emmanuel.
Oh, boy. This is my favorite from the list. It is by, like you said, Victor Lundberg. He's not a singer. He's actually, a newscaster from Grand Rapids, Michigan. And that's one reason why it's weird that this was an unlikely top 10 hit. Another reason is that it's just basically a grumpy rant about long hair and beards and whether teenagers are glue sniffers. And he even gets into whether God is dead or not. There's a lot. packed in there?
When was the Time magazine cover, God is Dead? I think it was around the same time, wasn't it?
Maybe he was responsible. Maybe
somebody remembers. Well, no, Nietzsche was responsible, but let's hear this.
You are not grateful to a country that gave your father the opportunity to work for his family, to give you the things you've had. And you do not feel pride enough to fight for your right to continue in this manner, then I assume the blame for your failure to recognize the true value of our birthright. Now, I would remind you that your mother will love you no matter what you do, because she is a woman. And I love you too, son. But I also love our country and the principles for which we stand. And if you decide to burn your draft card, then burn your birth certificate at the same time. From that moment on, I have no son.
You know, that encapsulates a lot of the feelings and a lot of the deep, visceral responses of that time and that period that we're talking about, of the other generation that, you know, Dylan sang about in his anthem song. When was that, Joel? What? Times they are changing.
That'd be 64.
Yeah, it was even before, right. Okay, by the way, let me read some comments here about favorite songs, because we asked. David says, my favorite song from the Summer of Love, Lighter Shade of Pale, I say now, but I was seven then, so it really was anything by the Monkees, embarrassing but true. And Sharon says, my tastes were really eclectic. My favorites were the soundtrack from Easy Rider and the Partridge Family. I was also seven. Noel says, how about Something Else by the Kinks? Did this have an influence on bands out here? Probably yes, Joel, yeah.
Yeah, the Kinks were always underrated.
Well, let's hear one of those songs that was not underrated necessarily, but certainly was is no longer part of our collective memory. This was I Was Kaiser Bill's Batman by Whistling Jack Smith. Let's hear it first. Have to say about that, Emmanuel Hapsis?
Well, when I saw that it was on the charts for 7 weeks straight, I was like, okay, what is this song? I played Listen. I wanted some answers because that title is odd. I Was Kaiser Bill's Batman. And I didn't find answers because, as you heard, it's just very passionate whistling. If the listeners want to go to YouTube and find a video of this, I highly recommend it. There's this man who was hired, he was an actor, to mime whistling on Top of the Pops or some show like that. And he looks like Spock's younger gay brother. It's beautiful.
I saw it, and that's a good way to describe him.
Yeah.
A very clever way, but nonetheless apt, too. Thank you, Emmanuel. Good to have you with us. Emmanuel Hapsis, again, is, well, let me actually identify him. Editor of KQED, what was the name of you? And host of
The Cooler, which you can find on NPR One and iTunes.
I can't find it on my screen here. That's why I asked you. Thank you. We're going to come back and we're going to hear again your ideas of what the great music was from the Summer of Love, your favorites, and we'll go out here with the whistling. And stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we are talking about and listening to the music of the Summer of Love, and would like to hear from you. What's your favorite song from the Summer of Love? We're playing some music, and let's go to the Doors.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on to the other side, break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah. We chase
fished our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. But can you still recall the time we cried? Bring on new to the other side. Bring on new to the other side.
We're talking about the music of the summer. Love, Joe Sullivan's with us, author most recently of Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest days. A lot of people identify the Doors with some of those dark days, don't they?
Well, the end off their first album, right? That's the opening scene to Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. And also, you know, I was just thinking about the fact that... Oliver Stone, what did you think about his movie? I mean, in terms of...
The Doors?
Yeah.
You know who produced that movie? Bill Graham.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was Bill Graham's big shot in the movie business. Didn't do too well. I think that was a money loser at like $60 million at the box office. Funny business, the movie business. I mean, you know, Val Kilmer is kind of an extraordinary actor.
One of the most difficult actors to work with, according to Hollywood lore.
But... Well, you know, you get the results with that guy. He really channeled some kind of Jim Morrison there. But it's a dumb, corny movie.
You know, there are people who go to Jim all over the world who go to Jim Morrison's grave. It's almost like Elvis in a way.
Yeah.
It's in Europe.
The Doors music has survived and endured. And I just think back on that 50 years ago. I mean, that summer, the debut albums by the Grateful Dead, the Doors, the Velvet Underground, Sgt. Pepper's from the Beatles, the Surrealistic Pillow from the Airplane. It was just an extraordinary bonanza of music, and the radio was full of all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, the Manuel tracks were on the radio, a mix, this bouquet of hits from the Monkees and all these commercial records, while this encroaching underground started leaking into everybody's. You know, Sgt. Pepper's really was the Beatles' best guess at what San Francisco rock band sounded like.
Well, they were certainly influenced by that. Let's go to our callers, and let's begin with Timothy. Timothy, join us. Hi.
Hi. Wonderful show. I was a 18-year-old coming across country in a VW bus with my brother from Maryland in 68. So I was a 18-year-old in the Haight-Ashbury.
And you were lured in part, maybe, by the music? Was that some of the magnet?
Oh, yeah. More than any, well, my brother had gone to California and brought back a lot of good records, including, we haven't mentioned yet, the Fugs.
yeah.
And their song about levitating the Pentagon, I thought was interesting. But as far as favorites, I would say from the Sgt. Pepper's, Within You and Without You was brilliant. Music, anything by Hendrix, but, you know, the Chambers Brothers, Time, was, now we're talking about 68. I don't know about 67.
Yeah.
But, no, I lived there, and then I'm a plumber in San Francisco. I worked at Bill Graham's quite a number of times, Bill Graham Presents, when it was there south of Market. And one of the impressive things about that was the sign on the wall that said, "The beatings will continue until morale improves." I thought it was brilliant. Of course, he borrowed it from somewhere else, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'd like to know the origin of that, but I thank you for those memories. And since you mentioned the Beatles, I thought we'd hear something from Sgt. Pepper. This is A Little Help from My Friends.
Bye.
And of course, the Beatles. Best band of them all, Joel Sullivan or Rolling Stone? Do you get into that debate? And by the way, that's the voice of Ringo Starr singing there.
I'm a professional. Michael, of course I get into that debate. Which side would you like me to take?
Well, who do you opt for? You, Joel Sullivan.
Today, I'll pick the Stones.
You'll pick the Stones today?
Yeah, tomorrow maybe the Beatles.
Okay.
Depends on my mood. I'm feeling mean today.
All right. Let me bring in some more callers. No doubt not mean, but Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Wanted to thank both of you. Joel, I was a fan of yours for years. Still
thank
am.
You.
I was back in New Jersey during the Summer of Love, but I got out here in a VW bus in 1973. a little late. I was a big fan of a band called the Moby Grape, which made it somehow back to New Jersey because of a guy I knew who played the guitar, and a band called Fever Tree, which only had one album as far as I know, but it had an amazing first cut that had a feedback piece of guitar work that, shall we say, used to interrupt our pipe smoking every time we hear it. I don't know if anybody there knows Fever Tree.
San Francisco Girls.
There you go. There you go. The only Kindle drum I can.
All right. Thank you for that. We're getting a bad line there. So let me go right to another caller. And this is Elena joining us from Vacaville. Elena, hi.
Hi. Great show. I really enjoy it. And it's really taking me back down memory lane, mainly because that summer of 66, I had just my entire family got up and moved from New York.
In a Volkswagen? You'd be running
Volkswagen
the string
bus,
here.
Yeah.
No Volkswagen. We actually came by bus, by Greyhound bus. And it was such a mind-blowing experience to get out to San Francisco and see what was going on. It turned me on to music that I think I never would have been turned on to had I stayed in the East Coast. And it really opened my mind to so many other possibilities in so many ways. So for me, it was not only a summer of love, but it was a summer of growing up and of learning new things and just totally changing my life set. It just kind of took me in a different direction. So I think it did that for many of us. I think I was just turning 13, and I think for many of us that age, it just became a totally mind-changing, life-changing experience. And surprisingly, my favorite song was the one everybody seems to hate, If You're Going to San Francisco, Wear Flowers in Your Hair. Because I did. I would go out and make these flower garlands and put them on my hair. And it was just really a great experience. So thank you for the show. It's really taking me back to some really good times.
And thank you for your memories and for your call. I appreciate hearing from you, Elena. And let's hear next from Rich. Rich, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Great show as always. I just wanted to mention the crisis here compared to 1967, the current music culture is virtually non-existent, you know, due to changing social economic conditions, closure of clubs, exodus of musicians, drain the city's pool of talent. And, you know, the music industry, you know, to increase their margins, decrease the aesthetic substance of the products they market by dumbing it down to the lowest common denominator, but artists are ultimately responsible for the state of the art, and it will eventually become a lost art due to their ubiquitous practice of playing cover tunes instead of creating original new material.
Well, I'm glad you weighed in on that, and Rich, I thank you for the call. You brood about that at all, Joel Sullivan? You know, those changes, you look around, you see all, you know.
It's been kind of glacial. But 50 years ago, what we were listening to was the product of some kind of genuine effort of our generation to make its own culture. And it was greeted with such enthusiasm. And within 10, 15 years, the corporations had moved in and taken over the music business. And 50 years ago, it was small, independent visionaries that ran the music business. 15, 20 years later, it was all international corporations. And they started applying corporate marketing methods to the whole thing. And what you have now is no longer really a culturally based pop music situation. It's an entertainment industry. It's a commercial enterprise.
Good question from Brendan. Why in San Francisco? Why did this happen here as opposed to Chicago,
LA,
or Seattle?
I can answer that. So when I did my book, Summer of Love, I talked about like 200 people that were involved in the scene here in the earliest days. Almost all of them came from out of town. And every single one told me they came here because they read On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
Yeah, there it is. Let me read some more comments. Keith writes, the music of that era shaped everything. It was eclectic. Dan Hicks, Love, The Sons all came out of that era. Just outstanding. Bob writes, my favorite song from Summer Love was The Fool by Quicksilver Messenger Service. And James writes, in 1967, Country Joe and the Fish had a song called Superbird. I was 9 years old, living in San Francisco, and still know the words. Country Joe and the Fish were famous for their Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die, and they played at Woodstock, but Superbird was the forgotten prelude to it. Well, let's hear Country Joe and the Fish. Section 43 by Country Joe and the Fish. Let's talk about them, Joel Selvin.
That song takes me right back to the ballrooms. It sounds exactly like psychedelic rock of San Francisco 1966-67.
Which is what it is. Let me hear what some other listeners want to say here, and let's go to Lynn next. Lynn, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Lynn, are you there?
Yes, hi. Here I am.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. So I moved from Ohio to San Francisco in 1967 in January. I knew nothing about what was happening out there at all. I just thought it sounded like a cool city, and I hated Ohio, so my girlfriend and I said, let's go to San Francisco. So I ended up living on 7th Avenue, working at UCSF. I was an RN. I was 21. And I worked at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic on my days off, and I volunteered. And I never, ever got into that scene of that kind of music. But what I loved was things like Paul Simon, 54th Street Bridge song, and Groovin' on a Sunday Afternoon, The Young Rascals.
Actually, the Paul Simon song was called Feeling Groovy was the subtitle of it. So you got all that grooviness,
Yeah, and I loved James Brown and The Temptations. And I just really didn't get into that whole hippie scene at all because I was 21 and I was earning money at UC as an RN. And I wanted to go to Joseph Magnum's and buy cute clothes and catch boys and the Domino Club downtown. So even though I worked at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, it kind of turned me off because of the drug scene. I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to be better than that.
Well, so you were not a part of what Ted Rosak called the counterculture, but you're bringing back a lot of memories when you mentioned Simon and Garfunkel. And
the Domino Club. Wow. Didn't they have artist models at the Domino Club?
Oh, yeah, we got free hors d'oeuvres. We didn't have to eat dinner. I have your book, by the way.
Oh, you're the one.
But she mentioned Motown and Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, you know, they were part of that whole world as well, but in a way a separate world, a separate planet, like she's suggesting.
San Francisco was very much on the edge of the Western world and isolated by itself. And the psychedelic movement that emanated from here after Augustus Stanley Owsley Stanley started privately manufacturing LSD in 1964, like the first million doses came out of Berkeley, right? So, I mean, this was the locus for a very special kind of cultural movement that spread rapidly after 1967, but before that first year and a half, the first 2 years, it was just a very small thing amongst a few people here in San Francisco.
And let me thank Lynn for her call. And Michael says, your guest mentioned five main bands of 1967. Who were they?
Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Country Joe and the Fish. Those were the original five headliners of the San Francisco ballrooms. And I also want to mention, honorable mention to the Charlatans, who were the first headliner, and they fell off the plate almost right away in grand San Francisco style.
And here's Robert, who writes, Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth still gives me the chills. It was released in January 67 when I was born. Happy 50th. And speaking about birthdays, Peter tweets, don't forget to mention Carlos Santana, born 70 years ago today. Carl tweets, I was overseas for all of the late 60s, but was struck by two songs, Sunshine Superman by Donovan and Signs, Signs, Signs Everywhere by Five Man Electrical Band.
I think that's a little later.
I think so, too. Yeah, I'm with you on that. Let me bring another caller in here, and that's Casey. You're on. Morning.
Good morning. I don't want to start a fight, but I would disagree with him about the Charlatans. But anyway.
Let's fight. Come on. No.
No, I mean, they were a seminal group. They started things. You really have to see some documentaries on them. Maybe you have.
I'm in the documentary on them, actually. But no, what I said was they fell off the plate. They were so San Francisco that they self-destructed before they even really had a chance to do anything. And I think all the guys in the band would admit to that.
Well,
they were wonderful. They were inspirational.
Yeah. Okay, but here's the thing. I started off in San Francisco working at the Jazz Workshop, the committee, and the reason I'm saying this is because I want to give you my street cred so you follow up with my question to you. And I then got to see at that time things that were going on at the Galaxy and the committee, and there was a little rock and roll scene with groups like the Bo Brummels, Paul Revere and the Raiders. And that's what I really wanted you to talk about, was that group, because I actually did one of the posters for the Family Dog. I worked for them, and I love all that period very, very much. And but you know, that little scene that led up to Longshoremen's Hall was
North Beach
kind of,
in 64, 65, when the go-go things were happening and before the topless deal was super exciting. Jazz Workshop and El Matador. El Cid was cool. The Condor was a go-go club.
Carol Dodo was there.
Carol Dodo, that was before she had her silicone injections and went topless. She was Sly Stone's girlfriend. And Sly Stone was all over Broadway at that time, doing solo shows. And Broadway was cool.
Live. Oh, the comedy was fabulous.
Comedy. But, you know what I remember is I remember they had one of the discos had a glass cage outside, and they would send one of their go-go girls out to dance in the glass cage over Broadway. And you couldn't hear the music, but you could see the dancer, right? It was one of the strangest sights
go-go
ever.
Go-go girls.
I know.
Where are we now? Ubiquitous porn on the internet.
Where are the go-go girls? Yes.
Would you talk about the Bo Brummels and those groups, please? They were
The Bo Brummels were San Francisco's answer to the British invasion. They were kind of discovered by Big Daddy Tom Donahue, who was a major figure in this city. He was a top 40 disc jockey on KYA, and then he pretty much invented underground radio on the FM dial. And he had his own little label in San Francisco, Autumn Records, and he found the Bo Brummels. He always liked to tell you that a hooker turned him on to him. And I always listened to hookers, he'd say. And then 19-year-old Sly Stone, Sylvester Stewart out of Vallejo, was another Tom Donahue discovery. And Sly Stone was the producer of all those Bo Brummels hits like Laugh, Laugh, Just a Little, Don't Talk to Strangers. And Sal Valentino was the vocalist. He's one of the great vocalists of rock, unrecognized. And Ron Elliott wrote all the songs. And, yeah, that was the beginning of the San Francisco scene, the Bo Brummels.
And we thank you, Casey, for the call. And John tweets, what about We're Only in It for the Money? Zappa's brilliant response to Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, I got to sleep on Owsley's floor, go to San Francisco and get the crabs. Yeah, Zappa is pretty much the great social commentator on the hippie scene.
And Heather writes, please talk about what was happening with the black music scene at this time, including soul and gospel.
It's so exciting what was going on with soul music in 1967. And it mirrored a lot of the things that were going on in the black community in general, a rise in militancy, a kind of self-awareness. But you think about it, like 1967 was not only kind of the height of Motown, but it was the emergence of the Southern soul out of Memphis and Muscle Shoals. There was an extraordinarily rich rhythm and blues scene going on in Oakland, Chicago with Curtis Mayfield and Jerry Butler. Black music was a parallel universe that was absolutely exploding with the same kind of level of creativity. I mean, 1967 was the year of Aretha Franklin's hits.
Well, San Francisco may be the music of love, but Motown and Detroit was the music with Berry Gordy where so much began. Julie writes, the assassination of President Kennedy, followed later by Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, the sudden forced draft in 1964 to fight a war in a little Asian country we had never heard of. Drug use came back from Vietnam with our boys. That's what the 60s was to me. The Summer of Love was a brief last gasp of a generation to trying to return to a world that made sense. And let's return to our callers, and let me go next to Bob in Saratoga. Bob, you're on.
Well, thank you. It's nice to hear Joel again. I met him at the premiere for the Wrecking Crew movie, and there's nobody who knows more about the scene than Joel. As an old radio guy, I can tell you 1967 was a watershed of great music and great change. I was listening to the Doors song that you played earlier, and people don't remember that there was a lot of commentary that resulted in that song, for instance, being edited. The original lyric was, "She gets high, she gets high," and even the version you played had the edited version of, "She gets, she gets." You know what I'm talking about, right, Joel?
Yeah.
There was a good deal of editing of lyrics in those days.
Yeah, there was a lot of censorship. The Stones going on, Ed Sullivan couldn't even sing "Let's Spend the Night Together."
Yeah, unbelievable. Thanks for that, Bob. And let's hear something else from this period. Let's talk first about with Joel Sullivan, though, before. Well, let's hear it, and then we'll talk about the group, famous group. And of course, his big brother and the holding company, Down on Me. Janis Joplin is in again. There's just a big musical stage show about her.
It's on at the Geary Street right now.
Did you see it? Curran?
I saw a version in New York a couple years ago. You know,
can I give a review?
Well, it's sort of strange. You know, I mean, I remember Janis pretty well, and it's like odd to see somebody playing somebody that you remember. I don't know that guy, Ron Silver, was that his name, the actor that did the Bill Graham
yes.
show? That was so strange to go down and watch this actor try and portray someone that I'd spent so much time with.
You know, here's a little fact that you maybe even you with all your head full of facts about this era. You remember a guy who called himself Dr. Rock, Eric Israel?
Yeah, used to be on your AM radio show all the time.
Yeah, he was a radio guy and everything. He and Ron Silver were college roommates. Now, there's a fact.
Wow!
That's really out of obscurity.
That one hits me.
Tell me about Big Brother and the Holding Company, though, from your perspective.
Big Brother and the Holding Company was, in many ways, the quintessential San Francisco Haight-Ashbury band. They were formed in a jam session in the basement of a Haight-Ashbury mansion that was being used as a rooming house. And the manager was Chet Helms, who would start throwing concerts at the Avalon in competition with Bill Graham at the Fillmore. He was the big brother, and the Holding Company was the band. And it was his idea to bring his college friend Janis Joplin out from Texas to join the band. She joined in like May of 1966, and suddenly they'd gone from a kind of industrial, garagey jam band into something that had this very exciting ribbon running through it.
There's a comment from Pat, and maybe you can, I don't know if the story is apocryphal or not to this day. She writes, Otis Redding started writing the lyrics to Dock of the Bay in August 67 while sitting on a rented houseboat in Sausalito, California. It is true. Yeah.
True. And you know what else is? Get your head around this. He'd been listening to Sgt. Pepper's all summer, and sitting on the Dock of the Bay was Otis Redding's idea of what a Beatles record would sound like.
Well, here's Otis Redding. Let's hear it.
This is the love crowd, right? We all love each other, don't we? Am I right?
So moderate.
Let me hear you say yeah! All right. I've been loving you too long to stop now.
That's a great Otis Redding. That's from Monterey, too.
Monterey
Live
Pop.
From
That's,
Monterey.
Talk about the summer love. That's June 1967. June 17th, I think, 1967.
And you can hear him talking about the love and all that response to the love, yeah?
No, he stole the show at the Monterey Pop Festival and really established not only his own career but soul music itself in the underground, which is a euphemism for young white people.
Well, Marie writes, the conversation is taking me back to sitting in various Indian bedspread, wall-covered, smoke-filled rooms listening to that far-out, quote-unquote, music, good times.
Glass beads, too. Glass beads, right, with the Indian bedspreads?
And water beds.
Water beds are later. But, you know, Indian bedspreads.
Well, water beds.
They come in the 70s. That's a real, you know.
See, it all gets conflated in my mind, some of it at least.
You know, the thing about the hippie thing, it really happened and it was over so quickly, but the inauthentic replication continued right away.
And still goes on in different forms. Anyway, glad to have you, Joel. Thank you for being
Michael,
with us.
Michael, it's always great.
Joel Selvin, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to give credits where credit is definitely due. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Senior editor is Dan Zolp. Engineer today is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald. Our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny. And I don't want to stop now.